Okay, well, good afternoon. Welcome to probably what is the first live continuing legal education program in Minnesota in the past few months. Today is July 23rd, and we're in Roseville, Minnesota. And we have I didn't advertise this program a lot, but we have a group of three attorneys here taking the course, and as kind of an experiment in outdoor learning. In addition to the three of you, I am recording the program. I'll probably wind up using it for a podcast program too. So during the course of the program, I'll probably say some code numbers for the podcast listeners to use to report their attendance. So why are we, and I already took attendance, so I can dispense with that. The first technical thing, okay, I'd say I'm about 20 feet away from you. This thing, does that make it harder to hear?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. So, okay, I'm gonna stay 20 feet away from you because, yeah, so this is the kind of, this is the reason I wanted to kind of do this experiment to see what works and see what doesn't work. I don't know if the podcast listeners can tell that my voice does get a little bit muffled when I have a piece of cloth covering it, and when I don't, it works better. Now, the one thing I would have had to ask permission from the city of Roseville for, I think, is a sound system. So for doing an outdoor program, it probably would be a good idea to have a speaker and a microphone to make it a little bit easier to hear. The three of you sitting 20 feet away, that probably is not an issue, but it could potentially be with a larger group. And the other thing I'm going to ask the three of you and anybody else listening on the podcast, if you do have access to or know somebody who has access to a parking lot that they would be interested in lending out for a little while, one thing I want to try is a drive-in CLE program where you would drive in. I would be standing, or whoever the presenter is would be standing there talking, and you would listen on your car radio. So if anybody is interested in doing that kind of experimental program, please let us know that as well. So anyway, what today's program is, like I said, we're meeting here at a park in Roseville that until recently I didn't know existed. I even have to look up the name of the place, Keller Mayflower Park. It's a small city park here in a residential neighborhood in Roseville, Minnesota. And I did call the city, and we kind of agreed, no, we don't really need any particular permission to do a program here. But why am I doing this? It would work just as well doing it by Zoom or by doing it by telephone conference call or something. But I think it's important to kind of do it as a demonstration of the possibility that it is possible to do activities outdoors. Today the weather is beautiful. In January, well, it'll probably be a little bit more problematic doing it. There is a recycling truck about to drive by, so I'll have to speak up as it comes closer. You can probably hear it in the background on the podcast. So sitting in a classroom or a meeting room of some kind would probably be more ideal in usual circumstances. But I think it's important to show that it's possible to do this sort of activity outside, particularly with respect to, I'll hold the recorder up here so we can, there goes the recycling truck. So maybe, okay, he's turning around. No, he's headed down the other way. So that source of interference is gone. But one issue, as everybody is aware, is that schools have been closed in the state of Minnesota since March. That's true in most of the nation. Well, some kids do great with distance learning, going to their Zoom classes, studying at home. For some kids, that just works out great. Other kids, not quite so much. So it seems to me that as schools start trying to grapple with the issue of how are we going to come back and have in-person classes, well, it seems to me that taking advantage of outdoor spaces is maybe part of the solution. So if kids want to get together for the for one lecture a week or something, rather than going into the building, and I think we're going to discover that being in the building is really what the problem is, because the air being recirculated over and over. And as you'll see, we have one student over here actually helping me out today. My daughter, who's going to be starting at Roseville Area High School this fall, whatever that means. Well, she's been obviously involved in forced homeschooling for the past 3 months. We really don't know at this point what going to school in the fall is going to entail. So I think it's important for different groups to be out here. Obviously, a group of me lecturing to a group of three lawyers is going to be a lot different from trying to herd 30 kindergartners or something. But still, because the kindergartners can be a lot easier. Obviously different issues present themselves, but just kind of showing that it's possible to do it. So that's why I had her take a couple of pictures. So I'll probably put something on my website or on my blog talking about how this goes. But the main topic of today's program is going to be some recent decisions from the Minnesota courts and some other courts from around the region. Obviously, there probably none of us have been inside of a courthouse for several months now, because for the most part, the courts have started working virtually. So most hearings are done, telephonically in some way or another. But I mean, that can't last forever either. So the main business of the Minnesota, or one of the main pieces of business of the Minnesota Supreme Court over the past few months, has been various orders on how to deal with the coronavirus situation. At first I was thinking, well, if I'm going to do a live program like this, maybe what I should do is talk about what those orders are. And then the more I thought about that, I was thinking, well, that's probably not going to work too well because it's changing on an almost daily basis. So I prepare the program, and then the next day everything is going to be changed. But I do have a link in the course materials that you can click on, and it's a summary of, it goes to the Supreme Court's website where you can see the various emergency orders that have been put in place over the past few months. Like I say, pretty much everything is shut down for in-person hearings. However, there have been a few jury trials. Starting out kind of experimentally in June, because one issue is, somebody charged with a criminal offense, well, they're entitled to a speedy trial by jury. And there is a multitude of problems with doing that. For example, if I got today in the mail, if I got a jury summons, I don't know what I would do about that. Normally, I would say, yeah, that's my duty to go and serve. But at this time, I wouldn't want to do that. As our governor always talks about turning down the dial. Well, my personal dial is turned way down, and I'm not going into any kind of building. In fact, for the past several years, I've worked as an election judge. I'm not doing that this year. Normally I would take that as a civic duty that I have to fulfill, but I would be extremely reluctant to do that. The Minnesota Supreme Court has a number of guidelines in place about how jury trials are going to be handled. For example, the jury box isn't going to be used because they're all sitting too close together. So, you'll have some of the jurors sitting over there, a couple of the jurors sitting back in the stands. So so forth. And also, they recognize the fact that a lot of people are going to be uncomfortable serving on jury duty. So the jury summonses that they send out, they have been sending out many more than they would normally require, because they expect that so many people will not be able to serve. And in fact, I guess even in normal times, the rule kind of is that you can get one extension of time for jury duty kind of for without having to explain why. So you say, I can't serve on jury duty right now, and they'll say, okay, well, we'll put you on for 6 months from now. That's more or less automatic. But there, a lot of people are taking advantage of that, so they have to send out a lot more jury summonses than they normally would. In fact, interesting, I noticed the Iowa Supreme Court just yesterday handed down its guidelines for jury cases because they're opening up a little bit faster. In fact, it sounds like they plan to, you know, have civil trials going on within a month or so. They included a lot of the same kinds of guidelines of, you know, extra summonses going out, more than would be normally needed, and just all these many, many physical precautions they have to go through. And also, of course, in addition to changing rapidly, all those rules change on a county-to-county basis. So again, if you want information on what the courts are up to, you're going to have to look at the court's website, probably check out the individual county. But anyway, other than that, even though the Supreme Court is, you know, meeting by Zoom, just like everybody else is, they have been, they and most other appellate courts have been very active. Here comes the recycling truck again, so I'll speak up a little bit more. We're going to start looking at some of the cases handed down by the Supreme Court. And Wednesday is the day when they typically hand down decisions, so there are a couple just from yesterday. I usually don't spend a lot of time talking about the attorney discipline cases, but about a good portion of the Supreme Court's work is attorney discipline cases. So just one case I wanted to point out to you, just as a reminder to everybody to be careful, is the In re Quinn case. Mr. Quinn got, sounds like he was admitted in the 70s or something, so he's an older attorney. Well, he's suspended now for 18 months for misappropriation of clients' funds. Well, that sounds bad when somebody says you misappropriated client funds. But when you read the opinion, it was more a case of him kind of being sloppy with things, because his 18-month suspension basically boils down to misappropriating $300 from the client. And where he was trying to be kind, it sounded like he was trying to be kind of accommodating. And then there might have been some other aggravating factors in there. But it was one of these things where the client came in and said, I want you to file this bankruptcy petition Monday morning. So he worked all weekend and he got the money up front and he was going to file it Monday morning. And then Sunday night, the client said, well, you know what, actually, it looks like I can negotiate with this creditor, so let's hold off on filing it. And then they talked about what the fee was. Well, one of the items of the fee that he had already collected was the filing fee for the court, which was about $300. Through sloppy accounting, that wound up in his personal checking account. So he misappropriated $300 from a client. So like I say, there were a couple of other aggravating factors in there. But be careful when it comes to your trust accounts. Is the main lesson from the Quinn case. Yesterday's big case, though, from the Supreme Court was, for our podcast viewers, I should occasionally point out some code numbers. So those of you who are live here today, and I don't have any, I guess I can't find my pen. Oh, here's my pen. The podcast listeners, I'm going to give a series of code numbers. And the first one is A13, A13. So you'll need that when you report your attendance. Yesterday's main case from the Supreme Court was State v. Jorgensen. And in this Jorgensen case, the defendant was charged with coercion. And the coercion statute prohibits various kinds of coercion. If I say, give me $100 or I'll beat you up. Well, that's coercion. Or give me some money or I will expose a secret or deformity or publish a defamatory statement or otherwise expose you to disgrace or ridicule. If you do one of those things under this statute, that is coercion. And in this particular case, as in many such cases, I assume, the defendant broke up with his girlfriend. Things kind of went sour. And at some point, he was talking to the father of his girlfriend and said, you know what I might do? I might release a video in which your daughter talked about smoking marijuana. And I'm going to give that video about smoking marijuana to her employer, to the Department of Human Services, and to the professional licensing board that licenses her. It doesn't say what kind of license she had. But somebody, you know, so if I came up to you and said, I'm going to release that video about you smoking marijuana to the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility unless you hand me some money. The father didn't take too kindly to that. He didn't want to hand over the $25,000, so instead he called the police, and he was charged with coercion under that statute. And his defense was, well, that statute violates the First Amendment. And the district court and the Court of Appeals agreed, and he took it up to the Supreme Court, and they also agreed that that statute is void on its face for violating the First Amendment. Now, the state argued that these were fighting words. You know, that comes under the fighting word exception. And they said, no, that doesn't really come up under fighting words. Well, another exception is a true threat. The cases talk about if you make a true threat, that is not protected under the First Amendment. So the Supreme Court said, well, first of all, these weren't fighting words, but this is not a true threat, because a true threat, that's a term of art, basically it has to be, you have to threaten to do something illegal. You have to threaten to do something unlawful. And in this case, well, there's no law against handing over videos to the licensing boards or anything else like that. So he was, he was making a threat, but it was not a true threat, because it was a threat to do something that he was entirely within his rights to do. And the Supreme Court ran through a number of hypotheticals, and the attorney for the state even conceded that, well, yeah, these hypotheticals, yeah, they would be a violation of this law. For example, one of the hypotheticals was a school employee sees a kid smoking, and they say to him, you're not allowed to be smoking, so I'm going to confiscate those cigarettes. If you don't give them to me, I'm going to tell your parents. And the state, apparently at oral argument, said, well, yeah, that would be coercion under this statute, because he's threatening to make this report. So the Supreme Court said, yeah, no, that's why this statute is void for being overbroad, because the statute, you know, says that it could be a defamatory statement, but that's a perfectly legal defamatory statement. It's not tortious. So there was not a true threat, and the Supreme Court tossed out that statute. The opinion was by Justice Lillehog. The Chief Justice wrote a dissenting opinion, basically saying, well, we could have interpreted the statute a little bit more narrowly to save it, but that's not what the majority decided to do. So anyway, that was the big decision from yesterday. I think they ruled correctly on that one. Yeah, they ruled in favor of the defendant. The lower court had dismissed the case, and the state had appealed. So they affirmed that dismissal. That was this week. Last week, the Supreme Court decided White Bear Lake Recreation Association versus the DNR. Well, White Bear Lake apparently has been historically low water levels the last few years. Kind of a big deal out there, because apparently there are no streams or rivers that drain into White Bear Lake. It's just a basin there that mostly affected by precipitation, but by groundwater level. The reason why it's so low is because the Twin Cities use a lot of groundwater. By tapping into the aquifer, lowers the level of the aquifer and consequently lowers the level of White Bear Lake. To dig a well, if you're a city, you need to get a permit from the DNR. So the allegation in this case was that the DNR improperly issued so many permits for the water level. They had two theories that they had the case under. One was, Minstat 116B.03, but that basically says you can sue anybody who damages the environment. So if I catch you dumping toxic waste somewhere, and you're damaging the environment, well, I can sue you for dumping that toxic waste. Well, here, or I suppose I could, if you were digging an illegal well, I could sue you for digging an illegal well because you are lowering the water level of my lake. But they didn't sue those people. They sued the DNR, saying that, well, your action of issuing these permits, that basically caused pollution or caused the environmental damage. The Supreme Court said no, because the statute says any person can maintain a civil action for pollution, impairment, or destruction. Well, they destroyed the water, you can sue for any conduct that causes that. So the plaintiffs argued, well, the DNR was engaging in any conduct, namely writing a permit. But the Supreme Court said no, that's not what they're talking about when they said conduct. You're actually talking about the physical action, not just allowing somebody else to commit that physical action. And then their other claim was, there's something called the public trust doctrine, because the state of Minnesota has a duty to hold the navigable waters of the state in public trust for the people. So that duty is imposed upon them, and here they failed in that duty. They breached the public trust in how they regulated these waters. But the Supreme Court said no, you don't have a claim on that either. And mostly that was a case of the court deferring to the legislature, because they said, look, there are hundreds of pages in the Minnesota statutes talking about how public waters can be regulated. You have to have a public access point here, and the legislature passed laws about issuing permits for well drilling and activities like that. They said that would not be appropriate to extend the judiciary's power, basically making the judicial branch micromanage issues that the legislature have tackled in detail. So basically telling these property owners, if you don't like the way that the legislature has been managing your waters, well, you really have to talk to the legislature. That's not really an appropriate issue for the courts to decide. So that was White Bear versus DNR. State versus Gibson. Let's see which one. Oh yeah, the defendant in this case was driving on Interstate 90 and took the exit for Worthington. At the end of the exit, there is a stop sign, and there's a white line painted on the road, when you get to a stop sign, well, you're supposed to stop. The statute in question says you shall stop at, it's going to hinge on the meaning of the word at, you shall stop at a stop sign or at a clearly marked stop line before entering the intersection. Well, this guy pulled off the interstate. He kind of rolled through the stoplight, passed the line, but then before entering the highway, he came to a complete stop, looked very carefully both directions. He was just, the most careful person in the world, but the stop took place after the stop sign. Well, the police officer pulled him over because of that traffic violation, and of course, he had all kinds of interesting stuff in the car. He had many items that were consistent with forgery. He had check blanks, and he had fake IDs, and he had all kinds of interesting stuff in his car. So I don't know if he got a ticket for going through the stop sign, but they took him downtown to charge him with forgery. All that evidence was seized. So there was a question was that traffic stop legal? And the district court the district court agreed with the defendant and said, no, that was not a legal traffic stop because you stopped at kind of the stop sign. So it hinged on the word at. It depends what is. In this case, it depends what at is. So they even quoted the Oxford English Dictionary that says at means a particular place or position. It's a mandatory requirement. Okay. The defendant found another dictionary. He didn't get the OED. He got, the dictionary from the dollar store or whatever. And he said, well, at really, one of these definitions says in or near the position of. So, you're meeting at the CLD today at the park. If we had been over across the street, we would still qualify as being at the park because we're pretty close to it. But also he pointed to some statutes as well. This statute also says that you have to stop and make sure that it's safe and make sure that no traffic is coming. And I wasn't able to do that back there. And the Supreme Court said, well, that means that perhaps you have to stop twice. Once at the stop, at the line where it is, and maybe again. So in this particular case, the court pointed out that the entire car was past the line. So maybe they left open the possibility of if you stop so that, your back wheels are behind the line, your front wheels in front of the line, they kind of left that question open. But stopping at the stop sign means, stopping at the stop sign. So they said the traffic stop was legal. That evidence should be allowed. And they sent the case back for trial. Let's see. I should keep track of the time, see how fast I have to talk. Okay. I'm always worried that I won't be able to cover everything. I'll run out of material. That never happens, so I always have something to say. Asbestos statute of limitations, I guess we kind of gloss over that unless you have an asbestos case. It's kind of specific to that. But basically, statute of limitations, when does the case accrue? The case accrued because at the time when you knew that the asbestos exposure had caused his disease. So in this case, that was pretty easy to prove because they actually had one case against one defendant earlier where they were alleging that they were damaged by asbestos. And interestingly, they only filed it. Yeah, the court held that the case accrued in January 2012 because they knew for a fact that the asbestos has caused the disease. And they filed the case in February 2018, so they missed the statute of limitations by just a month, but they missed it nonetheless. If you, another one, I didn't even, I'm not even sure if I read the whole thing, But if you practice in the area of medical assistance planning, you'll want to know about the Schmaltz case, which was decided on June 24th. Apparently, like I say, I'm not an expert in that area of the law, but you have to look at the assets held by the person going into the nursing home and their spouse, and how do you, there are certain rules for apportioning those. I believe the other spouse was arguing that this asset belongs to me and not to the spouse who was in the nursing home. So anyway, very technical discussion of that particular issue. We talked about jury trials. There are probably going to be a lot of, I guess if I was a criminal defendant right now, I'd probably say, I think I'll settle for a bench trial. Because for one thing, the people who do get their jury duty, it seems to me they're probably, this coronavirus has become so politicized that the people who say, oh yeah, I want to serve on jury duty, I'm not sure if you want those people on your jury. So there might be a lot of bench trials. That wasn't the reason for this one, but the Wissman case was a bench trial. And the defendant there was criminal sexual conduct. The defendant was 26 years old, and the victims were 12 years old and 13 years old. And the age obviously is an issue. It was under a statute where the age of the defendant was one of the elements. You have some water. Okay, I was going to offer. I do have a bottle of water here if you want one. Okay. So, but the age of the defendant and the age of the victims was an issue because the defendant being under 13 was one of the elements, and also the perpetrator being more than 3 years older. So here we have a 26-year-old and a 13-year-old, but one of the things that the state has to prove is the age difference. Probably looked kind of obvious because the attorney in his closing argument, which was actually a written closing argument, basically said, well, yeah, we concede that my guy is more than three years older than the victim. That's not really an issue here, Judge. The defendant said, well, wait a minute, that I was deprived of the ineffective assistance of counsel because you had to prove that I was more than 3 years old, and who knows, maybe I look young for my age or whatever. So he appealed, saying, ineffective assistance of counsel, and the court said, well, no. If it was like an outright concession of guilt, saying, well, Judge, my guy is guilty, but have mercy on him anyway, that would be one thing. But here, that was pretty clearly a tactical decision, not to anger the judge, saying that, how do we know for sure that my guy is 26 years old? Maybe he's 14. That probably wouldn't have been a very good tactical thing to do in the case. So that was not ineffective assistance of counsel. Also decided in June, the city of Minneapolis sick time ordinance. Is that preempted by state law? Because obviously there are state statutes talking about sick leave. So the plaintiffs there, business owners in Minneapolis, said, well, wait a minute. This Minneapolis sick time ordinance that says we have to give X number of hours of sick time, first of all, it's preempted by state law, and also it has an extraterritorial application. Because, for example, let's say I own a messenger service, for example, and I hire messengers, and my office is in St. Paul, that's where they report to work and whatever, but sometimes they have to deliver things in Minneapolis. Well, this ordinance applies to them because it applied to anybody who worked in the city of Minneapolis, even if that was not where they were based. So the plaintiffs argued that, that's extraterritorial application. That's really not proper. But the Supreme Court said no. It's valid for both of those reasons. First of all, there's not a fundamental conflict with state law, because the state law simply said, well, if you are an employer and you give sick time, here are the rules that you have to do to apply it. There's no state law that says you have to give sick time. And that extraterritorial thing, they talked about two cases from. They talked about one case, I forget, there are two cases. One, a Duluth ordinance. These are from the 1800s, where the city of Duluth had an ordinance saying you need a permit if you're going to blow up explosives within the city of Duluth or within a mile of the city limits. So if you're going to blow up explosives 1 mile away from the city limits, you need a city permit from us. And the Supreme Court had thrown out that requirement, saying, well, yeah, even though the blast waves might land in your city, you can't, you know, there's a line drawn on the map called the border, and it's there for a reason. So you can't do that. On the other hand, distinguished from that was a Minneapolis case where the city of Minneapolis regulated all milk sold within the city. So if you have your sick cow giving tainted milk in some outlying area, and then you bring that milk into the city to sell, you fall within that regulation. And there, the act of selling it within the city was enough. And here, the Supreme Court held that this sick time ordinance was really more like that milk case. Because if an employee is doing work within the city of Minneapolis, it doesn't matter that they also spend some of their time outside of the city. And the example they pointed to was security at U.S. Bank Stadium, or make custodians or whatever. All those people, I mean, the only place they ever reported to work was the stadium in Minneapolis. That's where, if somebody asked you, where do you work? I work at that stadium in Minneapolis. But the company they worked for was based elsewhere. So that was kind of like the extreme example that the Supreme Court gave, saying that that obviously the city has the power to regulate in that case. So even in these smaller cases like the messenger, they are able to do that. So the city ordinance was held valid there. I didn't tell you that there was going to be a quiz today. But, so there, here's a pop quiz. How many of you know what champerty is?
Very cheap wine.
Yeah, no. It's not that. That's a good guess, though. But champerty, you're very lucky then, because until a couple of weeks ago, it was illegal. And you would have gotten in a lot of trouble if you had engaged in champerty. Now you don't have to worry about it so much anymore, because on June 3rd, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that champerty is now legal in the state of Minnesota. So you don't have to worry about that. Although actually it might be illegal for attorneys. But what champerty is basically buying somebody's cause of action. In this case, this woman was involved in a car accident, and she had a lawsuit pending with a big personal injury firm downtown. She needed some money for living expenses. There was a company, the Prospect Funding Partners LLC, is in the business of loaning money to people who have lawsuit spending. And they advanced her $6,000. And the repayment agreement was, you have to pay it back with the amount increases by 30% every 6 months, up to a maximum of $25,000. And also, if she loses the case, she had no obligation to pay. She needed the money, and she signed up for that, and she got $6,000. In fact, her attorney even had to sign, saying, yes, I talked to my client about this. I'm cool with it. So go ahead and give my client the $6,000. She understands all the ins and outs of what's going to happen. So he signed it, and then the next year the case settled, and well, and the lawyer said, well, you know what, there's a law against champerty in Minnesota, so even though I signed this paper saying that we were going to pay it back, we're not going to pay it back. So so I guess understandably the champerty company went to court, but the attorney pointed to the 1897 case of Huber v. Johnson, which says that champerty is illegal in Minnesota. And this was a clear case of champerty. But the Supreme Court said, well, that was 1897, because we're going to overrule that now. So champerty, that is now permissible. Now, they did say a couple of things. First of all, I forget what rule number it is. I think it's rule 1.8. of the rules of professional conduct, saying you as an attorney cannot acquire a proprietary interest in a cause of action. So you can't engage in champerty, probably, with the exception of your contingent fee. And so, in fact, the Supreme Court even pointed out, well, back in 1897, when that case was decided, contingent fees were really frowned upon at that time, but times have changed. We have since allowed contingent fees. And now we're going to allow champerty also. Some states that's regulated by statute. So the Supreme Court said, you know, if we don't want champerty in Minnesota, that's a subject for the legislature to take up. But that contract is enforceable, and she has to make good on what she said she was going to pay. At this point, I'm going to give the another code number for our podcast listeners. B as in boy 62. B62 is our second code number. Legislative immunity was the subject addressed in Olson versus Lesch. This John Lesch is a Minnesota legislator in the district, actually the district bordering this one. Right now we're sitting in 66A. I think he's the legislator in 66B. So your legislator, I believe, yeah. He sent a letter to Mayor Carter, marked personal and confidential, and said, congratulations on getting sworn in as mayor. Here are some of my personal and confidential thoughts that I have for you. And one of them is, well, the person you're considering for city attorney, I don't like her. You should pick somebody else, because she has, quote, a track record of integrity questions and management problems. She's not a good fit for the job, so I don't think you should hire her. And I don't know if she got hired or not, but and he even said in this letter, I'm not sharing this letter with anybody. This is totally personal, totally confidential. Somehow she caught wind of it, and she decided to sue him for defamation, saying, I don't have a track record of integrity questions and management problems. And he said, well, you know, whether that's the case or not, I have legislative immunity, because both under the Constitution and under a statute, the speech and debate clause says that I can't be questioned anywhere for my speech and debate, and I have I'm in all cases except treason. I'm privileged, and I can't be questioned in any other place. So we have to throw out the case of legislative immunity. Well, the Supreme Court said, well, no, it's not an absolute privilege. You don't have absolute immunity over everything. And here, specifically, it was not relating to legislative affairs. Now, if he said, we're going to, fight to pass this bill, or what bill do you think we should pass, or something like that. But it was, the letter was marked personal and confidential, even though it was on his legislative letterhead. They said, well, no, you were not fulfilling your legislative duties when you sent this letter. Either under the statute or under the Constitution. So anyway, we already talked about White Bear Lake. Now we turn to Bedea-Makaska, and of course you need to learn to have that to roll off your tongue easily. Bedea-Makaska That, of course, is a lake in South Minneapolis, formerly known as Lake Calhoun. And some of the people in the area liked the name Lake Calhoun. The state went and changed it. A couple of jurisdictional issues about what issue they should cover it. The plaintiffs pointed to a statute that says a lake name cannot be changed if it's been in use for more than 40 years. Well, the name Calhoun has been in use for a lot more than 40 years. It was basically an issue of statutory construction. The statute laid out a very dedicated method under which the name of a lake can be changed. In Minnesota statutes 83A.05 et sec. It's a very detailed provision. They conceded that, well, the state kind of has this plenary power over the subject. The limitation on not changing a lake name after 40 years, that only applies for this statutory scheme. But they still have kind of this plenary power. Because they're the ones who print the maps, you know, they have to decide what to print on them. So they held that the ruling changing the name was permissible. I guess makes a little bit of sense. I mean, you can never change the name of it. Put about 1,000 years from now if they want to, change it. So it seems to me there ought to be some power to make those changes. Another criminal procedure case from May, State versus Leonard. Mr. Leonard checked into a hotel in Bloomington. The Bloomington police came into the hotel and said, went up to the front desk and, hey, can we take a look at the guest register of the hotel? Who's checked in today? They handed over the hotel guest register and, this is known felon, just checked into room number so-and-so. So they went up and knocked on his door and he said, hi, Mr. Leonard, welcome to Bloomington. By the way, can we take a look around your room? And he said, why, yes, you can look anywhere in my room that you want to. You can look at absolutely anything in it, but not my laptop, my phone, or this folder here. So of course, the laptop and the phone and the folder were the first place where they looked. Another forgery case. He had all kinds of forgery materials there. Wait a minute, that violated Article 1, Section 10 of the Minnesota Constitution. Not the federal Constitution, but that was an unreasonable search and seizure under the Minnesota Constitution. And the Supreme Court agreed, because going in and asking to see that guest register, that requires, in Minnesota, a reasonable, articulable suspicion. And here they were. They kind of admittedly were just doing a fishing expedition. So that evidence should have been suppressed. And without the phone, the laptop, and the folder, they didn't have probably don't have much of a case against him. So police, before asking to see that guest register. Now, I imagine the case would be different if the hotel just voluntarily walked into the police station and said, hey, you want to see a list of everybody who's checked in this week? That would be a little bit different. Minnesota voter data is addressed in the Sillick case from April, the state of Minnesota has a database with all kinds of information about every registered voter in the state, all kinds of interesting information that you can get, and it says, this data is confidential. On the other hand, the Data Practices Act said a lot of data is public. So the court had to kind of harmonize those two statutes. And the holding is the public data in those records are the voter's name, their address, their year of birth, their voting history, that is when they voted. You know, they voted in the primary in 2020. Information on what district do they live in, and their telephone number if available. So that's just the holding between those two statutes. The other data is private. So anyway, that's what the Supreme Court has been up to in the last couple of months. Let's see, the Court of Appeals, I guess, have one case that looked kind of interesting. What is this? State versus Serbus. He was arrested. It was a DWI case. Renville County, the officer was very accommodating. He pulled this guy over for DWI, put them in the back of the squad car because he was intoxicated. They were going to take him downtown, and the defendant asked the officer, before we go, could you go to my car and get my phone, my wallet, and my keys? And the officer said, sure, I'd be happy to do that. He went into the car. He found the phone and the keys, but he couldn't find the wallet. So he came back and asked the defendant, here's this stuff. Where's your wallet? And he said, well, it's in the center console, right next to the gun. So in addition to DWI, he was charged with prohibiting carrying a pistol on or about the person's clothes or person in a public place while under the influence of alcohol. So you can't carry a gun if you've been drinking about the person's clothes or person in a public place. And the issue was, well, is this a public place? And the Supreme Court said, yeah, it was a public place, because the public place they're talking about is the highway you were driving on, not the private place of the center console in your car. I guess the lower court had dismissed, so they reversed that and remanded the case. Let's see, a couple of these. I have another case listed there, but it's a pretty old one, an implied consent case. A couple of cases from some other jurisdictions, Lambert versus the Lincoln Public Schools. Okay, so here we are today. We're in a public park, and I noticed there was a sign over there that says dogs have to be on leash. So somebody walks by with an unleashed dog and attacks one of you. So you want some justice, so you... you're going to sue the dog owner, but well, they don't have any assets, they decided, well, sue me because I was overseeing this event where you got bit by a dog. I don't have any assets either, you decide, well, I'm going to sue the city of Roseville for not properly enforcing that anti-dog ordinance. And that's kind of what happened in this Lambert case. The plaintiff was a school student. In elementary school, she was dismissed from school at 3:38 p.m. They do things right down to the minute down there. So she got out of school at 3:38, went to the door where their mother was waiting to pick her up, and they went over to the playground. And they stayed in the playground for a while, and then at about 4 o'clock, after school was totally closed for the day. Somebody else came by walking their dog, while the mother of the was cleaning up after the dog, she had her 8-year-old, I think it was, hold the dog, and he walked over with the dog on the leash into the playground, and it bit the girl. She actually required surgery. It also bit the mother when she tried to rescue the daughter. So they sued the Lincoln School District because there's a no dog policy. There was a sign with a picture of a dog with a red line going through it. Apparently the school rule, as published in the school newsletter, says, quote, no dogs on school grounds. They said, well, you know, you were negligent in not enforcing that prohibition on dogs. The issue anytime you sue, and I don't pretend to understand it, but anytime you sue a city or any government entity, the issue is going to be discretionary immunity, because you can't sue a city or a government entity for a violation of a discretionary duty. Who knows exactly what a discretionary duty is? Well, I don't think anybody knows, because the courts kind of do this on an ad hoc basis. But the Nebraska Supreme Court said, no, this case was a pretty easy case. Because the defense was, well, yeah, we have that no dog sign there, but that's the rule during school hours. We have a policy of not enforcing that after school hours. We deal with it, you know, as more of a just a public park that we really don't, we don't bother regulating it. And the Nebraska Supreme Court said, that's kind of quintessentially the duty of, you know, how do you allocate your resources? And here, after 4 o'clock, after school is out for the day, if they decided not to do that, they don't have to do that. Why don't I give another code number here real quick? C91. C is in Charlie, 91. C91 is our final, I think, final code word. We have about 4 minutes. Another dog case from another state. Cohen versus Clark, a recent Iowa case, where this plaintiff had a very well-documented allergy to pets. She had an EpiPen. She had a whole box full of medical records saying that she was allergic to dogs and cats. So she needed a place to live. So she rented an apartment, and she made sure that she moved into an apartment that with a no pets policy. There was a big sign, no pets allowed here. Her lease said, this is a pet-free building. There aren't any dogs, there aren't any cats. This is not a place for pets. So she felt safe moving in there. And then a couple months later, another tenant moved in, and he didn't own a dog, but he moved in. Well, about a month after moving in, his psychiatrist came to be of the opinion that he needed an emotional support animal, that an emotional support animal was going to be the thing to have. So he got a note from his doctor saying, dear landlord, This patient needs an emotional support animal, so please let him have an animal. What do they do? Well, they called the Iowa Human Rights Commission, and they said, this person needs this emotional support animal. I said, well, you have to make reasonable accommodations to that person, and everything. And they said, but I have this other tenant who says that they're allergic to it. And they said, don't worry about that. So. They felt the need to say, well, okay, I guess you can move in. And they looked into the possibility of installing an airlock that would have cost $80,000. Decided that wasn't going to work. So they finally decided, well, you, Mr. Dog Owner, you can come in through this stairway. You, that's allergic to dogs, you go out the other way. Was this plaintiff greedy? No, she was not greedy. She went to small claims court, suing for 1 month's rent for a breach of the warranty of habitability. She lost. She got tossed out of small claims court. She appealed to the district court, and that judge just said, oh, this law looks very unclear to me. Therefore, I'm going to affirm the small claims court. So she appealed, and it was ultimately heard by the Iowa Supreme Court. They said, well, yeah, you have to provide a reasonable accommodation to the person who needs their emotional support animal, but you also have to provide a reasonable accommodation to this person. They said, well, how do we decide this? Because we have these two conflicting, because they're both entitled to a reasonable accommodation. They said, first in time, first in right. She lived there first, so... in fact, the landlord at one point even said, well, why don't we have, we own two buildings. Why don't we move you over into this other building? And apparently the Human Rights Commission said, well, no, you can't force somebody to move. The Supreme Court said, no, she does have a claim. So she gets her 1 month rent back. The landlord said, well, wait a minute, what about, I relied on the Human Rights Commission to say, well, you should have documented that a little bit better, maybe. So that's our other dog case from Iowa. So I see it is about 3 o'clock. Yeah, so there are a couple of other cases there if you do have any questions about. Well, thank you for attending this historic CLE program today. Like I say, I would appreciate any feedback that you have. Either send me an email or whatever if you have suggestions on how it can be done better. And also, if you have, if you have a parking lot that you want to make available for a drive-in CLE, I'd be interested in exploring that option. So anyway, any questions here? Well, hearing none, those of you taking the podcast, if you have any questions, feel free to email them to me, and I'll get back with you within the required time. But thank you for attending, and I